This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
This is going to be an interesting and much longer subject in the sense that, not merely because I run over time all the time, but because the time frame is you'd expect if you're talking about technology and industrialization is late 19th and 20th century. But in fact, it starts a lot earlier. So it'll take us back a little bit in order to get here. So let's start about preservation of food. The originally, of course, people preserved, they had to, because they were killing huge animals, killing mammoths and giant sloths and things like that. And they were relatively small groups of people. So they had to learn how to preserve it. They did it mostly by heating it over a fire and basically cooking it. They didn't have salt that they could collect somewhere. They hadn't yet gotten there yet. And so they didn't have salt. They didn't have vinegar. They didn't have the things that could be used to preserve meats. So they only could dry it, and they basically dried it over a fire. But it turns out they pretty early on they started to discover that cold could keep food, and the earliest that we know about in an actual technological development was in the 1770s BCE, which we know because of radiocarbon dating. That's how we can pin down what it was northern plains of Mesopotamia. The agriculture originated mostly in the northern plains, which is part of Syria now and northern Iraq, where there is some rain. It wasn't until somewhat later that they mastered irrigation, and then they could move down onto the lower plain of Mesopotamia, which turned out to have much better soil. So once they mastered that technology, they were able to grow a lot more. And the cities really originated in the southern plain of what is now Iraq. But up in the north, they discovered that in the winter, when it gets cold in the hills, they could make pools and freeze water and then build underground facilities, that is basically dig holes, and cover them over with reeds or whatever. They had wood up in the hills. They didn't have wood down in the lower plains, but they could use wood. And they built basically cellars, cold cellars, using ice that they froze in these pools that they built. And that's from very early in the second millennium of BCE. That's quite remarkable. From that point on, the idea of cool cellars were to preserve foods joined frying, and smoking, and eventually, because once they got into our agriculture, they did begin to collect salt around the seashores, particularly, and salt lakes. They were able to do that, so they now had salt, free salt, so to speak, not the stuff that you just get from eating meat, but stuff that you collected, and they also, since making of fermented drinks was one of the earliest things humans developed, earlier actually than agriculture, was ale and wines and so on. They also eventually figured out or left them too long and they turned into vinegar. So they then had vinegar and they were able to start to use that as well. So preservation didn't actually get in. It was a public activity. It was a communal activity, really, until the early 19th century. A Maryland farmer invented an ice box. He did it in order to keep butter that he was making on his farm cool enough to survive while he took his horse and wagon into Washington or Georgetown, which preceded Washington. And so that was a big step forward. And the icebox then became a major thing. It basically, what they did was to use a block of ice, which they put on top, not on the bottom. They put it on top because cold air descends. And they insulated the box with straw or sawdust or whatever they could find. And the problem was that they could only get the ice in the winter. So they would wait for, and they needed a block. So they needed the lake to freeze at least 12 or more inches before they started cutting. And they would use a saw to cut these blocks. The biggest producer of ice was obviously in the north, and Norway was in Europe, was cutting ice from their lakes and shipping it packed in insulation, because they'd lose an awful lot of it in transit, but they were shipping it to England and Scotland and other northern European. You couldn't get it into the Mediterranean, it wouldn't last, but the northern Europeans could get it, right? So you had then the beginning of the development of the ice house. They bring in this ice in a specifically built place with a lot of insulation. They put the food in there and be able to keep it. And it worked very well through the winter and into the early spring. They began to make ice making machines in the 1850s. Both by using compressed gas to cool the water, particularly carbon dioxide, but it made it possible. Once they invented those things, it made it possible to make ice throughout the year. And by the late 19th century, ice boxes were widely used in homes, and icemen delivered blocks of ice a couple of times a week. And so the idea of compressed gas used for making ice went back to the 1740s, but it was where a physician actually experimented with it. But it really only became completely used and useful in the late 19th century. And this is my grandmother's ice box. When I was a little kid living in New York City, we lived with my grandmother, and she had an ice box. The ice went on the bottom instead of the top, I think because she was a little old lady and she couldn't lift it. But the ice man came twice a week, and he was in a horse-drawn wagon on 103rd and Riverside Drive. And so this was one of my, one of the things that I never forgot, that whole ritual of getting the ice in there. And of course, it was where my mother kept the calf's liver, which I would refuse to eat. And there was one instance in which I spent the entire afternoon sitting at the table because I wouldn't eat it and she wouldn't let me get up. So I didn't have a high opinion of ice boxes for a while. Refrigerators were invented in the early 20th century. Wolf, who still has a company, a German company, Wolf, was the inventor of a refrigerator in 1913, and then others. They started using Freon gas in the 1920s. Frigidaire was founded basically in about that time and produced the first self-contained unit. That is to say, it had the Freon and the whole cooling system in the unit itself in 1923. It cost $714. That was when you could buy a Model T for $476. Just to give you an idea that it wasn't widespread immediately. And it really didn't pick up until after World War II. And so that's why the Iceman was still coming in the late 40s. The frozen food, actually, as something which was a common thing, was developed much earlier and in places where you could do it. in the high Andes, of course, the temperatures drop below freezing every night, and the winds are very dry. And so the Inca developed what we call flash frozen, or freeze-dried, goods. They would put things that they harvested or killed out overnight. They would freeze, and they would dry because of the winds. They'd leave them out during the day, and the winds would take the water, the dew and so on, take the water overnight, and then they'd freeze again. In 2 or 3 days, what you had was a freeze-dried food. And so, and it wasn't so much that people wanted to borrow, they couldn't, unless they wanted to live at 16,000 feet. They couldn't borrow that technology, but they could learn that it was possible to do and that it worked. It kept the food for very long periods of time. When you rehydrated and cooked the food, it wasn't so bad. So that was what was really important about what the Inca were doing. So in Australia, in the 1860s, this guy named Mort developed a technique to freeze meat. And he wanted to ship it to London. So in 1868, he started to try to develop something which could sit on a ship and keep the meat cold all the way, which is a long trip in the 1870s. But the point was really, in a way, the idea. We need, if we're going to make this work, we need refrigerated transport systems. And that was coming. In the 1870s, Carl von Linde developed the cold box. Also he used compressed ammonia and then later dimethyl ether gases. And his company sold 12,000 of those cold boxes all over Europe and the US. Most of the boxes were used by the brewing industry. They needed to keep their beer cold. But he also discovered a way to liquefy air, and he produced liquid oxygen and liquid nitrogen. So Linde was really important, because those frozen gases were critical for a huge number of uses. The acetylene torch, used in welding iron and steel, using it in medical work as well. He established a branch of his company just at the beginning of World War I, not good timing, since he was German. And it was seized eventually during World War II. It's still existing. And then it was made part of, it was just simply folded into Union Carbide. And then later that Union Carbide sold it to itself. It spun it off, as we now say. Flash freezing is another technique that was of critical importance in development, and it was learned by Birdseye, Clarence Birdseye. It's strange that, you know, we're all used to seeing Birdseye foods, that it was an actual name of an actual person, poor guy. And what he saw that flash freezing, when going way up north on hunting trips among the Inuit, and fishing trips, and he learned how to do ice fishing. And what the Inuit had been doing for presumably thousands of years was they brought a fish up and flopped it onto the ice, because that's, you know, there's an animal, and within a very short time, the fish was frozen. And what Birdseye understood or found was that when you actually cooked that fish, it had preserved its taste and texture to a much greater extent than freeze-dried or just, you know, frozen food of any other kind. So they taught him how to do this at minus 40 degrees. And when he came back to the States, he used liquid nitrogen, von Lenta's discovery, to create bird's eye pea food. And he started experimenting, and he figured out how to do flash freezing in what amounts to a food factory, in 1924, minus 45 degrees. He created the General Seafoods Corporation. He sold that company in 1929 to Postum Cereal for $22 million. 1929. I hope he didn't invest it. but that gives you an idea of that extreme cost or payments for new technologies is not just a modern thing. Bird's Eye was eventually bought by General Foods and then Conagra. So now let's turn to the stove. Here's a picture of the stove I've shown you several times. It's the earliest one we know, dates from the Han Dynasty, it's made of brick. It allows you to put a ceramic bowl into a cup, in effect, on top, and heat it. It's very nice, but the heat is always the same. No matter where you are on that stove, your heat is not going to change. So you can change the way things cook by the kind of bowl you put on it, but otherwise you have no control. What you really wanted to do was to develop something that would allow you to move things around. And that didn't happen, so far as we know, until very late. The earliest European stove that we know of dates to around 1490. We have a description of it, but we don't have it, so we can't see it. And the other big problem is that the word stove is used both for something you cook in and something you heat your house with. So it's not always clear which thing they're talking about when you get old records. This thing that you're looking at is an early modern Russian stove, which was representative of what you would have seen in Europe in that period, in the 16th, 17th centuries. It was basically a kind of fireplace, and it looks like and functioned like a pizza oven. You would put stuff in there. If you had a fire that would come over this way, you might get some heat on the top, but that's usually far. Most of the cooking was done in the open oven, as you would say. It's interesting that we were in Germany when I was a graduate student, and that was the way we heated. It wasn't the way we cooked, it was the way we heated our house. Was something that looked almost identical to that. And the cooking was also quite primitive, actually. It wasn't wood or anything, but it was pretty primitive. The real idea of a kitchen range originated with a British lord in the late 18th century. He was another one of these people like von Linde, who just was into inventing things. So he developed, for example, a flue. One of the problems with heating your house with a fireplace is that the smoke will often come out and just drift through the house. He developed a flue that allowed that to get rid of that smoke. At the same time, he built a brick oven with a brick kitchen range. But it was so expensive and so elaborate that only people like himself, lords, could, and the upper class merchant community could afford it. So, and ordinary people were still cooking on open fires most of the time. Then the other thing that's interesting is that a number of the inventions of kitchen things, including stoves, were done by women. In the 1850s, Mary Evard, who was an American, invented a stove which could be fired by charcoal or wood. Fire is on one side, and the heat, therefore, on the top varied. So the fire is on one side of the thing. That is critical, because with varied heat, you can make sauces. That was critical. The development of that kind of a stove or heating device was critical for the development, for example, of what we take to be French cooking, which has got a lot of different sauces in it. You cannot make a sauce on a very hot flame, on a hot stove. It has to simmer, right? So that was a critical development. And once she invented it, people started to build it. The gas stove was developed in England and started to be marketed in 1828. It's cleaner, obviously, and more efficient than the wood stove or the charcoal stove. And of course, you can turn it off, so it's more efficient in that sense as well. But you have to have gas. And gas wasn't really widely available until the 1880s in England, and it was later elsewhere. So in the late 19th century, you do begin to get a spread of gas stoves. But until that time, gas wasn't available in enough places to make it available to ordinary folks. Electric stoves was actually invented in the 1890s, but at a time when there was very little electricity anywhere in the country, and it wasn't really marketed a lot until after World War II. This is an 1939 hot point electric range, and what's strange about it is it looks a lot like a modern electric range. Well, what's changed, of course, is the nature of the rings and so on, which now are flat and are heated in a different way, but it gives you an idea. This I'm sure almost everybody in the room would recognize. So now let's talk about food production. That's food making, food production. The first farmers used a stick plow. They basically took a stick and went and drove in the ground and pushed it themselves along a furrow, made a furrow, and then they planted seeds. That was all they had. This had a number of consequences. One is you could only do it in soils that you could actually manipulate with a stick. Right? So, for example, the alluvial soils of the lower Mesopotamian Valley, which are phenomenally rich, are also too hard. They cake. And so it was very hard to do that with an individual working it. Up in the north, in the hills, in the northern plains, where you got more rain, got softer soil, you could do it. Right. They originally domesticated sheep and goats as their animals. About 2,000 years later, they managed to domesticate aurochs. That's the wild bovine, and they're big. One of the things that's interesting about bovines is that in most cases, when animals were domesticated, they were enlarged by breeding. The breeders bred for size, fatter meat, better meat, and so on and so forth. Aurochs were larger than domesticated cattle. Even oxen. And our aurochs as a wild animal survived into the 18th century. And then when it's extinct, but there apparently is enough DNA for modern scientists to be now trying to essentially recreate the auroch. I'm not sure it's a good idea. I don't think they were particularly domesticated type animals, but it was took a long time to do that. And the way you did it, by the way, was by basically stealing calves and raising calves, right? If you try to domesticate an adult, forget it. You are likely to end up with broken bones. But so that's the way they did that. The horse, by the way, which had been ridden for 1,000 years, which originated in North America, but then migrated, it died out in North America and migrated into Eurasia. That had been used and ridden in the Central Asian plains for thousands of years. But there were limits. Until you if you're riding it back, bareback, or if you put a seat on top of it, a saddle, unless you have stirrups and horseshoes, you really can't do that much with horses. But for one thing, horses' hooves are incredibly fragile. And if you're riding in a region which was once under ice, and the ice had dropped its rock load, that you're going to have horses breaking their hooves all the time until you get horseshoes. Horseshoes were invented in Central Asia, and stirrups are the other problem. Once you have stirrups, you can do a lot more on a horse than you can if you don't. You can swing a large sword. You can use a lance. If you try doing any of those things without stirrups, you're going to fly off. So that also was invented in Central Asia. In the 8th century CE, those inventions got to Europe. And the way they got to Europe probably is through the Avars. The Avars were predecessors of the Hungarians in migrating from Central Asia to what is today Hungary. And they were conquered by Charlemagne at the end of the 8th century. And he brought back lots of gold, but apparently also brought back ideas like horseshoes and stirrups. So that meant that you could start using horses for war. You could actually use them, and you could ride them longer and do more things with them. But one thing you still couldn't do was to use them to pull plows. And the reason was that the harness that had been used, and that the only one they knew was, where is this thing? Is it here? Okay. The only thing that they knew was a kind of harness that choked a horse when it pulled any weight. It went across the windpipe. So it wasn't until the 9th century that they developed a harness that was on the withers, in other words, on the shoulders. And the result was that you could now attach a horse to a plow or a wagon, and it could pull those things. So in the 9th century, there was a radical change. Because of this new technology. Horses can pull as much as an ox at twice the speed, which meant that if you had them attached to a plow, right, it was going to be much more productive agriculture. And one result of that is that from the 10th century on, so far as we can tell, European population grew by 2% per year. That doesn't sound like a lot, but think about the miracle of accumulated percentages. All the way until the Great Famine in the early 14th century, and then the Black Death in the middle of the 14th century, the European population was growing more rapidly than any other population in the world. And it was mainly because of the horse. The other thing, by the way, the horse did, interaction with horses has effects on our health. Horses are the only domesticated animal that gets respiratory diseases. They get pneumonia. They get all kinds of those common respiratory diseases. And there is a long argument about whether they gave the diseases to us or we gave it to them, since we're the other animal that gets a lot of respiratory diseases. But the other thing that people, you know, when people say healthy as a horse, horses aren't healthy. Horses require veterinarians, right? And it's very probable, by the way, that the development of a veterinary profession or specialists, people who specialize in taking care of animals, really was boosted by the fact that horses became more and more important in the economy. They wouldn't have been bothered with dogs or any of the other things. And cows don't generally need it. It was horses that needed to be, because they were so valuable as work animals. One of the first uses in the development, by the way, of the large horses, of the workhorses, the Percherons and the Belgians and so on, was to pull barges along small canals. Because even before they started to ride them, especially ride them in war, and use them in plowing, they were already using them on canals. This gives you an idea. Here's a picture of it, and you can see that this is down on the shoulder. And what this did, by the way, and also something that happened in the 9th century, is that they invented the wheeled plow. The wheeled plow could be much heavier than the old. They use an iron share. They could dig deeper, and they could pull faster, and they were using horses, and they were in European soil, a northern European soil on the North German plain, which stretches from the Ural Mountains all the way to the Midlands of England, is very rich soil. And so the problem was you have to know how to work it, and you have to clear the stones in certain parts, which is why you see a lot of stone fences, right? So this introduction of the horse was of critical importance. The next big change was cattle herding. You would not have seen cattle herds in medieval Europe or early modern Europe. People, farmers might have one or two cows. They used them for milk until they would kill them because they were no longer able to produce. They would kill calves of various kinds for meat, but they weren't herds. There wasn't a meat industry. One reason why you couldn't transport it. When you killed an animal, you had to eat it. You could dry it. Eventually, you could cool it, keep it cool, but you couldn't ship it because you had to keep it cool. So it wasn't until the 1870s, and mostly in this country and in Latin America, that you begin to get large herds of cattle. And an important part of that was the development of the Chicago stockyards, starting in the 1860s, and the railroads. So you could move cattle to the stockyards to be slaughtered, and then you could, if you could figure out how to move the meat, you could move the meat out by railway. And they produced, as I note here, 80% or over 80% of the pork and beef that was consumed in this country, which is quite remarkable. And by the way, seems to be, it's still the case that the Midwest seems to be the meat-eating capital of the United States. When I was riding across the country to my 50th reunion, one thing that really struck me once we got into the Midwest is you go into a store, meat and potatoes. Unbelievable amounts of meat and potatoes, right? And people who look like they ate a lot of beef. So the Swift Company was created as, it was a butchery in Boston in the 1850s, moved to the stockyards where the meat was coming in, and developed a refrigerated rail car that's revolutionary, that allowed them to move meat all over the country. The Armour Meat Country was founded, company was founded 2 years later, or a couple of years, actually, later than the original Swift Company, but before Swift moved to Chicago. And of course, it's still a very large operation. Refrigerated rail cars allowed them to ship fruits and vegetables. Once they had them, they realized they were created for meat, but they could use fruits and vegetables as well, so that you could gather food for cities from much further away than you used to be able to, because those fruits and vegetables go bad, and this would allow them to be transported. It also meant that it encouraged the development of new crops like oranges and grapefruits and so on. It's interesting, navel oranges came to the United States from Brazil, but actually, and they seem to have developed in Brazil. Ordinary oranges with pits come from Central Asia and Southeast Asia. That was part of the reverse Colombian exchange in the 16th century, that orange growing and grapefruits and so on were being grown, along with things like apples, pears, peaches, apricots, and so on. All of them were old world products that were brought to the new world. And the development then of the United Fruit Company, which began to bring bananas. And bananas originated in Central America. So Costa Rica was its home as a crop. Sugar, as I said earlier, people didn't have access to sugar as a product that they could use before the Middle Ages, before they made contact with Indonesia and the Philippines, where they were growing sugarcane, where sugarcane originated. And sugar was one of those spices that was brought to the West in small amounts at extraordinarily high prices, like black pepper and other kinds of things that were brought from the Far East. And as part of the Colombian exchange, they started taking the plants and finding new places to plant them. Right? So the Portuguese started planting them in the Canary Islands and other islands that they controlled in the Atlantic, and eventually, of course, in the Caribbean, and then in the southern U.S., and so on. So sugarcane now becomes a bulk product, starting really in the 19th century. And they start to use it for more things than just sweetening food. And they start to use it to make candy. Eventually invent machines to make candy. So John Curtis invented chewing gum, and then Wrigley took that sap-based gum and made spearmint and juicy fruit gum in the 1890s. And then he started to develop his company we all knew about, and which gave him also an access to a baseball team, or two, or three. In 1865, Wunderlich, who is a German immigrant, founded a candy company. One of his employees in the 1880s invented those little corn things that we all loved when we were kids. In 1890, the Piedmont Candy Company, and again, note that these are down in the South, that Piedmont is in North Carolina, where they're pretty close to where they're growing sugar in that period. He began doing peppermint puffs, and sugar consumption doubled, and teeth fell out, I suppose. From 1880 to 1915. That's not a very long time for the doubling of the consumption of a food. Chocolate came from Central America and Central Mexico. The Aztecs made a bitter chocolate drink from it with a lot of spices. It was obviously discovered when the Aztecs were conquered, and the Europeans sent it back home, part of the Columbian Exchange, in effect. And the Europeans made it at the beginning just the same way that the Aztecs did. It was a bitter drink. But then they began to sweeten it in the later 16th century. It took them almost a century to do it, but they finally started to do that. And they also created hot chocolate shops, which were in competition with coffee shops and were of critical importance in cultural affairs because people gathered in them. They were like coffee shops in that sense. And then the American company, Hannon and Company, which was founded by Hannon and Dr. James Baker in Boston in 1764. Hannon died when he was off trying to buy cocoa from the West Indies in 1779. Baker took it over. He bought out Hannon's widow and renamed it the Baker Chocolate Company, which we still deal with. Anytime you go to buy any kind of baking chocolate, for example, it's likely to be Baker chocolate. One of his employees, whose name was German, invented a sweetened baking chocolate, which then was used to make German chocolate cake. I always thought German coffee cake was German. Nah, it was just named for this guy who was named German. Hershey got into it, he had a candy company in Lancaster, PA. He went to the Great World Exposition in Chicago in the 1890s, and he saw that German chocolate-making machinery. He founded Hershey Chocolate Company and produced the first chocolate bar in 1894. And then Hirschfield, a couple of years later, invented the Tootsie Roll. And one of the things to keep in mind is that in those days, chocolate was a winter product because in the summer it would melt. Right? And so Clarence Cain invented an alternate to the traditional chocolates that Hershey and others were using, which didn't melt in the summer. And that was the early 20th century. Processed foods really in a way start in the mid-19th century with margarine, which was made from it was made from tallow, which is animal fat, and it was invented basically for the army, which couldn't keep butter. It wanted to take butter with it, but couldn't do it because it would go bad. So margarine wouldn't go bad, and the army could pack it as part of their food when they were on some kind of a campaign. And also, it was cheap, and the poor could afford it, and they couldn't afford butter. So it was made from this wasted waste fat that would have been otherwise thrown away or used. Tallow was also used for things like sauteing. It was that kind of a product. Crisco, which is made from animal fats, and it was invented in 1911. So that, again, it was a way to use calves' feet, which would otherwise be thrown away. You rendered them, they produced a fat, and you made that into Crisco. Makes you feel a little strange when you're baking. The other thing that development was that flour had been ground for, at that point, 10,000 years. But it wasn't until the 1870s that a flour milling machine, roller mills, was invented by a Hungarian. And white flour was really produced. White flour was a lot finer than the flour that had always been used. It produces a bread that rises faster and has more than, and also it rises more than traditional flours. So you got a much lighter white bread, and it got it faster. And this is a period when industrialization of food is taking place. People, one of the big changes in the mid-19th century in European and American life was that you go in the early 19th century, most people made their own food at home. They brought home raw goods and they made whatever they were gonna eat or store. Whereas by the 1870s, people are going to shops. There's a consumer society. The food is being manufactured elsewhere and sold through these shops. And so white bread that will grow, you know, will rise faster and produce this very nice product becomes very valuable as a result. Bottling and canning, as we call it, really developed in the early 19th century as well. It really took off when Mason and ball jars were invented in the late 1850s. It allowed everybody to can and changed an enormous amount. At about that time, Gail Borden, who was male, not female, invented a way of canning milk. So now milk, which you could never transport very long or keep very long, could now be kept for a long time. And Borden, of course, became a big, eventually a big company. He did it for the Union Army before the war, but it was an important part of the rations of the Union Army during the war. Food fads start to take off in the 19th century, the second half, and a lot of them are connected to religious movements, particularly various kinds of Christian movements. A lot of the things like Adventists and other Christian sects that we all know about now really originate in the 19th century. They don't go that far back. And a good example was Sylvester Graham, who was an Adventist in Michigan. He was in New England, but he had a lot of things going on in Michigan, and he was promoting vegetarianism. He didn't like white flour; it's too refined. He didn't like sugar sauces such as mustard and ketchup, and he didn't like meat. So he invented the graham cracker, which is made from whole wheat and molasses, right? And which we most of us have in our kitchens still today. Horace Mann's wife developed kindergartens with her sister, but she also published a book about Christianity in the kitchen. And again, it was a way of using the religion to determine what kind of food you should make and eat. So she didn't like cakes or puddings. They weren't Christian. So Henry Ward Beecher, who was the brother of Catherine and Harriet Beecher Stowe, he advocated against white flour. White flour was this industrial flour, and they really didn't like it. As I mentioned, the Adventists, they invented some vegetarian foods, one of which was wheat flakes, which were invented by Dr. John Kellogg, who was a member of the community. His brother started the company, the Kellogg Company, and invented cornflakes in 1898. C.W. Post visited the Kellogg's in the 1890s and then founded Postum Cereal Company in 1895, and its first product was grape nuts. Right, so what you're getting is industrialization, and some of it is tied to the fact that there are these movements that see food as culturally important. You can eat this, you can't eat that, and so on. And some of these companies take advantage of that and develop out of those movements, those fads. Additives. There have been additives from early times. Early ancient Egyptians added alum, which sounds awful, sounds dangerous actually, to increase the sharpness, the astringency of food. It's like vinegar or something of the sort. Chinese use burned wax. They would burn wax to speed up the ripening of fruit, right? And they, of course, used salts to preserve food once they were able to get salt, which took place after the invention of agriculture. In the 19th century, they began to add chemicals directly to the food for special effects. So the English used red lead to color Gloucester cheese. I have a feeling that nobody's going to be buying Gloucester cheese after this. The French used copper arsenite to make sweets green, sweet things like candies, a dye, which of course is a big subject right now. Chemical additives became important as preservatives and colorants and taste enhancers in the 20th century. They've always been controversial. It isn't just now. It isn't just Kennedy and his friends who are making them controversial. But the natural food movements of the late 19th century just tried to get rid of all that kind of thing. Very sensitive to that. So that's what has happened with additives. I need to finish up, and I'll just be as quick as I can. I want to sort of summarize what has happened to us, or what we have done to ourselves, by inventing all this cooking and foods. By domesticating animals, we were living with animals, and we therefore got a lot more disease than we had ever gotten before, than hunter-gatherers ever got. Hunter-gatherers weren't hanging out with animals. They were killing them, but they weren't living with them. The result was respiratory diseases, various kinds of viruses and bacteria just weren't passed back and forth between the animals until agriculture and domestication. We didn't eat processed grains. We didn't eat dairy products. We didn't eat salt. We didn't eat butter before the advent of agriculture. So hunter-gatherers weren't obese, and they didn't have coronary disease. We can tell this from their DNA that we can now recover from their bones. They also didn't get cavities. But their teeth were different from ours. They were aligned differently. They were edge to edge, not one behind the other. And the reason for that was that they were tearing at meat and tough vegetable products, and we grind them. They didn't. Right? But those teeth were better shaped than ours. They also lived longer than early agriculturalists. We didn't start really catching up with what hunter-gatherers achieved in terms of life expectancy until the late 19th century and the advent of sanitation, particularly, and improved diets. The hunter-gatherers got their fats from the fat from animals, but the fat from wild animals is not as much as the fat from domesticated animals. So we bred animals to become marbled with fat, and they didn't do any of that. So we have suffered the consequences of marbling our beef and going for that. Having bought a couple of steaks this morning, I'm guilty as charged. That's the thing. One of the things that the hunter-gatherers didn't do, of course, is drink milk after weaning. So they might have been nursed by their mothers longer than modern children might be. But once they were weaned, that was it, right? They weren't keeping animals to milk them, right? They were killing them to eat them. And a result of that is that a very high percentage of the world population turns out to be gluten intolerant. Some change that takes place after weaning that makes you react to milk products, to lactose. Note, by the way, that they started making and eating cheeses in ancient agricultural societies. Cheeses don't have lactose, don't have gluten. So they're not a problem of gluten intolerance. Celiac comes from proteins in grains, which are to a certain extent released by grinding. So hunter-gatherers didn't have that problem. And the decline, one thing happened, there was the decline of meat eating for a time when the big animals began to die out, and before domestication basically was able to replace meat, was a lowering of iron deficiency problems because they weren't eating as much meat. So the other thing about hunter-gatherers, they lived in feast and famine. If they couldn't catch an animal for a long time, they just didn't eat. They could eat fruits and things they could find, but they couldn't really get the kind of... One result of that is that we evolved to be able to withstand starvation. And by the way, that was clear from Inuit and other Arctic peoples and so on, who very often went periods when they were basically in famine, but survived it because the human creature had evolved to be able to survive a substantial amount of what we would call starvation. And that's it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.